You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Thinkum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Anthasyakhliya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail. All right. Hello, listeners of CITR 101.9 FM. This is Randy, and if you are a regular tuner in of the station on every other Tuesday, you know what you're listening to. This is Dog-Eared Radio Book Club. This is a bi-weekly book club that comes to you through the airwaves of CITR 101.9 FM. As I said, I'm your host, Randy, and I trudged all the way here on the 99B line to get here to do this show live. So I think I deserve a round of applause, even if I can't hear you. Thank you so much. And speaking of which, I'm going to do a quick little intro to the show, and then we'll dive into our guest this week. So as always, this is a bi-weekly book club on CITR 101.9 FM. You can always reach us on social media at Dog-Eared Radio Book Club on Instagram. I don't do any of the other forms. One is enough for me. And you can always email thoughts, books, suggestions, anything like that. If you want to get in touch, just email dogearedbookclubradio@gmail.com. Now, without further ado, welcome to our guest this week. Hello, Matt.
Hello. My name is Matt Plue, Matt Plukin, whatever you want to call me. Hey, howdy. Hello.
Hi. I realized I had the wrong mic on, so that was my bad.
No problem.
Yeah, I mean, they still heard you.
Okay.
So, awesome. Yeah. So how did you find your way here today?
I live on campus. I'm a first year. I'm currently in Totem Gang. I also sludged through here in my, I was going to wear boots, but they're absolutely soaked right now. So I trudged through in my sneakers, which was a bit of a pain, but I trudged through regardless.
Well, I appreciate it. And I was also in the Totem Gang first year, so ooh, I can understand the struggle of making it all the way to the nest.
Nice.
It's a little bit of a trip. But yeah, do you want to give us a little bit of an intro? So you said you're first year. I know you're new to the station.
Mm-hmm.
And how are you finding everything?
Honestly, okay, if we're talking in terms of the station, this is fantastic. Where I come from in this little suburban town, you're not going to find anything as thought out and thorough as something like CITR.
Right.
You know, you might have something that some kids would be like, hey, let's start up a little radio show and then try and get their town to approve it. But you're not going to see something fully funded that's in the middle of this university where everyone's working together. It's so interlocked. And Nardwar represents it. Oh my God, that man is my idol. I could write an essay on that man. I don't know. I love that. I love the detail put into everything around here, and I just feel completely comfortable coming to CITR.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And is the student portion of your life going that well?
That's why I didn't want to start with the general because the student portion, wow, it is overwhelming. I think that's a pretty accurate word. As a first year, I think something nobody ever really told me is the most important lesson I've learned is that university has made me realize how little time there actually is in a day. As a kid,
bingo,
I just got as much free time. And I really was not appreciative of how much free time I had to just maybe play piano, play games or whatever. And then when I actually have university, when I'm interacting, when I have to do homework, when I actually have to make time to work on my passions instead of just working on them whenever because I have the free time, I realize I have to actually schedule. And I realize how fast adulthood, even though I don't feel like an adult, I realize how quickly that slippery slope really gets to be.
Yeah. No, I think that's, as someone who's in their final year and is coming up on 6 years out of high school, which I can't fathom, I totally agree. And I think one major change that you don't realize is how much, like, university is entirely basically self-taught.
Yeah.
You pay these professors a lot of money, and they just talk to you for an hour, and then you go home and you learn everything. I've been teaching myself Spanish for the last 5 years,
nice.
So way to go. We love it. But because of that, I think it's so hard to manage your time versus, like, in high school, you know, like most of what you're doing gets done during the day. Mm-hmm. So you go there and it's like working a job. Like I think high school is more similar to working a job than mm-hmm. university. University is its own thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, you go between these hours, you do your work, you might have a bit of homework. But I remember like I would in high school, I had hobbies. Like I was part of extracurricular clubs. Like I would do so many things. I'd go out for dinner. I remember going to coffee shops after class mm-hmm. and then going home and watching a movie. I can't fathom doing all of those things in a day anymore.
Yeah. But the thing I really hate about high school is because of that structure, it really felt like the classes were structured. You had to take this and that. And personally for me, honestly, when I turned 17, I realized, okay, I know how to do what I want. I know what I really want. I know my passions. Get me out of these classes. And as soon as I was able, while I did have the time, being in university has really allowed me to really focus in on those hobbies. Like I write poetry, I write essays, I write fiction, and I make music in my spare time. Mm-hmm. And when I was in high school, all of that kind of got pushed aside because of how strict it was. But with university, it's just you. And so that's another part of university that I'm learning is a lot of the time is spent looking into a mirror, both literally and metaphorically, just realizing who you actually are. Because all of high school, you're just like, okay, here's an idea of what I think I am. You go to university, oh, that's the nitty gritty. That's who I actually am.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Very insightful.
A little too insightful.
I hope you don't lose that insight after your first semester. Speaking of cynicism.
That's a perfect segue.
I think that's a very good segue. So I didn't even say this at the top of the show, but it doesn't matter. I'll say it now. We're talking about the book Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut today. I don't necessarily have any major content warnings for our discussion today, as this novel doesn't deal with anything super intense beyond there is discussion of war. I'm definitely going to talk about like colonization, things like that. But as far as like any of the dark humor that I personally think is not appropriate, we're not going to be talking about that. So just for listeners, I wouldn't be too worried about that. But yeah, this book was something.
Something is definitely a good word to describe it. The format and just the way it's even structured in the first place is unlike any other book I've
read. Well, if this book was supposed to make you feel like you were going, I don't know, like my brain was shutting down, like I would read like one of the short little chapters and then I'd be like, okay, and like, I don't know, like it went against like everything in English when they're like, oh, like a paragraph needs to be an idea, mm-hmm. you know, a sentence is a full thought, like, and then this book is like none of those things.
Exactly.
It reminded me of when I had to read The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
I haven't read that,
Well, you can. You might like it. I hated everything about it. It's like a apocalypse novel. About a father and son that literally wander down a road.
And that's the whole book?
That's not actually the whole book, but that's what I felt. And I remember just like the way it was written, it was like incomplete sentence, incomplete thoughts, like mm-hmm. random lines. I think the chapters were also short. And I remember like raising my hand to my English teacher and being like, why are we reading this? This is breaking all the rules. And she's like, well, he's allowed to do it. It's the artistic license. And I was like, well, I want my artistic license. Like, I want to be able to write like this.
Yeah. Something I think a good way to describe this book is that while reading it, it feels like there's nothing, but it's simultaneously completely overwhelming.
That is a really, yeah, because the entire time I was reading, I was like, nothing is happening. But then when I got to the end of it, I was like, oh, wow, that was actually way too many things.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't even, like, there's so many characters. There's, like, the whole thing is just all of these people.
Yeah.
But I do know how we're going to start off. So as listeners will know, we're going to do the segment where I read a description of the book, and then we discuss whether or not it's accurate. So the description isn't, like, it's not like a description, like a synopsis. I think it's more like a praise to the book.
I hate when the books do that. It's like, oh, let's look at what the book's about. And it's like some random review from 1967.
Yeah.
It's like, Kurt Vonnegut is a genius. It's like, I don't care. What is
it
actually
like
about?
What is the book? But this is what it gives me. This is like on everything. This is on the book, on the physical book, but it's also on the internet and stuff. Okay, so Cat's Cradle is Kurt Vonnegut's satirical commentary on modern man and his madness. An apocalyptic tale of this planet's ultimate fate. It features... Oh, okay. Sorry. Just... anyways, as the protagonist, a complete original theology created by a... I didn't even try to... I'm like, what is all of these words? I am so sorry for those listening. I'm as confused as all of you. A calypso singer and a vision of the future that is at once, fatalistic and hilariously funny. A book that left an indelible mark on an entire generation
I've
of readers.
I've never heard these words.
Cat's Cradle is one of the 12th century's most important works and Vonnegut at his best. Okay, this, like... I'm so sorry. So the reason I was skipping is there's words that I don't necessarily want to say because I don't think that they're quite appropriate. And also there's words I don't know. Like, I don't know what the word indelible. I'm going to look it up.
That felt like what reading the book was like.
Yeah. You were like reading it and you'd be like, okay. And then they get something and you'd be like, what?
Yeah.
Like, why did you say that? Okay. So indelible means... of ink or a pen making marks that cannot be removed.
I mean...
I think... Okay, so if I were to... So first of all, for listeners, general reactions, I did not like this book. and you did, Matt.
This is one of my favorite books.
Yeah. So this is going to be very interesting. But I think it'll be good because I'm so interested to hear someone's opinion. Because like the entire time I was reading this, which is the last week, I read this in the last week, I would like be reading it with my roommate in the room or whatever. Or I went home and I saw my dad and I would be reading it and I'd just be like, ugh. And they'd be like, what? And I'd be like, this book, I just know. Maybe, yeah. Anyway, so very funny experience. But I think this, the attitude of this description, because I think this is like self-praise. Like, to me, it feels like Kurt wrote that. I'm going to call him Kurt.
Okay.
It feels like Kurt wrote that and was like, yeah. Like, I am, this is one of the greatest works of the 20th century, exactly. And I'm just like, okay.
I mean, to be fair, that's what it feels like, when I read any 20th, any, like, praised 20th century work.
That is true.
It's like, oh, check out this book from 1984, called 1984, or maybe Animal Farm. It's like, this is a world-dominated masterpiece. It's like, I don't know what any of this means. It's like the same energy as... New York Times bestseller.
Yes. Okay. But funny thing, you can pay to be on the New York Times
bestseller.
Like, that's what I feel like. I'm like, yeah, okay, this book is like fine. Like, yes, it makes some comments about things like war and religion and stuff. But like, I have read a lot of other books that make these same arguments. Like, Kurt is not, you know, a never ending, everlasting genius.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very curious, before we go too much further into this book, have you read, I think it's Slaughterhouse 5?
I have. That's another one of my favorites, honestly. I'm assuming, did you not like that?
I haven't read it.
Oh.
It's just when I told people that I was doing this book for the show and I said that I was reading it, everyone's like, oh, well, you have to read Slaughterhouse 5. It's good. It's so much better. Like, that's his best work. So I was just curious
how it compares. I didn't suggest that one because that's not as sci-fi, I'd say. That's more, I guess, I don't know how to describe it. It's more just centered in fiction with sci-fi elements. I feel like this one has a much more – dives much more into what science fiction is supposed to represent and the state of science in the world. Mm-hmm. Slaughterhouse-5 is generally really – delves much more into just the idea of anti-war in general and how Kurt's focus on humans and their psychology and how conflict originates is really found in Slaughterhouse-5 with, like, because he was in the war, in World War II, he was at the Dresden bombings when that happened, and so the whole book is about time traveling through periods of this character's life, such as through the Dresden bombings, and when they're in a glasses doctor. I don't know what the term for that is, like optometrist or something.
Oh,
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just as nonsensical as this book from a literary perspective.
Right.
But I really like it just because it's very good anti-war sentiment, I'd say.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. This
It's again, it's not like he's the first person to ever say war is bad. Like the people who review these books are like, this is the first time I've ever heard someone say that colonization is bad. I've never realized that.
Yeah, this is the first time that a guy has told me that
a white man is telling me that colonization bad.
Yeah,
no way.
I can't believe it. It took me until 1980, whenever this book came out, to realize it.
1,980 years of human life to figure that out.
Yeah. Pretty wild. Yeah. So anyway, we should just get into it. Okay. So now we've read the description. Accuracy. I think we've decided it doesn't matter. Like this description does
nothing.
It's
kind of nonsensical. But I feel like there's some value in the fact that it is completely nonsensical.
Yeah.
Not in a literal way, because it just doesn't make sense, but in a kind of a symbolic way.
Mm-hmm.
In an ironic way as well. Because in trying to describe the book, it feels like reading the book itself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very it's also one thing that I will note is like everywhere on here, so it says that the entire book is black humor or dark humor.
That's such a weird term.
I know, it is. Because I have one single moment I laughed out loud in this book.
Mm-hmm.
One single moment. Which I'll talk about later. I have the quote marked. But I find just like I'm scared. Like, I'm scared of books that were written in 1980 by men that say that they're dark humor.
Mm-hmm.
Because typically, to me, that just means that they're offensive. That's like, that's all it means. Because it's like, oh, like, it's, you know, not even absurdist humor, because I think that's different in my opinion. But, but even from that standpoint, I don't understand why this is marketed as like unless the only way I could see it is like the entire thing is dark humor because it's so like, it's so outlandish.
Mm-hmm. I think that's mainly, at least from my perspective, I see it as described as dark humor. I'm trying to look at this in an optimistic perspective. I see it as dark humor, not in the sense that it's trying to be provocative or just shock value, but in the sense that the time when this was written, it is completely nonsensical, and compared to what is like mainstream at the time, the narrative structure, the character arcs, and how the narrative is layered out and how the jokes are interwoven with that narrative, that is what makes it, I guess, what this book calls "quote unquote" dark, but I don't think that's a good word to describe it. Because when I hear the term dark humor, I also just think, okay, you just want to like be offensive and shock people.
Yeah, yeah. Or the other way it's good is like, I think it's the show Dead to Me on Netflix. Like when people make jokes about people that die in their lives as like that is like dark humor, but it's like personally like for them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only time I get it. But yeah, I agree with you. Like most of the time it is just like, oh, like I just want to provoke people because I know that I can.
I think a better word in my opinion would be abstract humor because it's not a linear like, okay, let's set up the punchline and stuff like that. It's because the humor is kind of layered on top of several events of the story. I'll get into this later. But the events that the humor in this book is that an event will happen that will make you think, what even is that? And then another event will happen. It'll be like, okay, what is even going on? And then another event will happen, which will make you think back to the first event, which will be dramatic irony. And you're like, okay, now I just see that this is ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, I think actually, I think your description is better. Yeah. Honestly, I didn't read anything about this book before. Because I was like, well, I have to read it anyway, so I might as well just read it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read the book after. And there's also a quote on the front from, you guessed it, the New York Times.
Yeah.
Which says, quote, a freewheeling vehicle, an unforgettable ride. I don't know. Anyways, the praise is just whatever. We can leave that and move on. So here's where I would attempt to give an overview, as if people who haven't read the book are listening. I don't know if I would be so far. It's been, but I will say our conversation will probably be as much of a mess and nonlinear yes. as this book is. So mm-hmm. that's my defense. Mm-hmm. So be prepared. But yeah, so this is where I attempt an overview, and I truly don't know how, but I to do it in two sentences, this is what I came up with. So this follows a story of a story, because it's a story, but then there's, like, he's writing a book.
Yes, that's
so
true.
He's relaying writing a book, and it's this guy named Jonah, and he sets out to write a story about Dr. Felix, is it Honecker?
I think it's Honecker.
Honecker, thank you. Who created the first atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. And it ends with him being the president of San Lorenzo?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, San Lorenzo, which is a small island, and then the end of the world. Yeah, so that's, I don't know how to provide any more of an overview, because literally something new happens on every page.
Yeah.
It's wild. But that's kind of like the point of it. And then, as we kind of referenced in the beginning, this book is told through like very short chapters. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, but it's not even like a story per chapter, which is weird.
Yeah. And some of the chapters are not even equal in terms of how much they provide to the plot.
Yeah.
It feels like, honestly, this is probably how it was written. It feels like Kurt had to write a chapter every day, and some days he was like, oh, I have to write a chapter today. We're just going to give this guy blue pants. And then he just went to bed. That's what it feels like.
Honestly, I like to imagine that.
That's kind of fun to imagine him writing that and reading
because
it.
Because I can see it. Like, some of these chapters, and also the names of them, like, never index your own book. Well, that one I actually remember. But the one before that is Communists, Nazis, Royalists, Parachutists, and Draft Dodgers.
This is like how I come up with song titles. I just think of random words.
Yeah. And it's truly wild. So yeah, I once again, I think just like sums up how absurd this book is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think we already gave mostly our general reactions. I will say, this is what I said to my dad when I like summarized my feelings about the book. I said, this book is the reason why I don't read books written by white men in the 80s. This is actually, I haven't read a book written by a man in years. Mm-hmm. So this was, I broke this. Well, actually, Anne Ender's Game. So this wasn't even the first one. But yeah, just there was to prove that, on page 122, I have a sticky note, which I wrote, quote, I truly don't think I understand anything in this book. What is the point? End quote. I'm just trying to be honest here.
That's fair, honestly.
And then on top of that, I also had several sticky notes. Basically, anytime Jonah, the writer, was talking about women, I had a sticky note that says, I want to vomit.
Yeah.
And that summarizes, I think, my reaction to the book.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so I think with that, we can move into maybe chatting about the main characters. I say this as if I don't even know who the main characters would be, but I think, obviously, like, the narrator is, like, important one.
I think the main characters can be the narrator and the three children. Maybe not the third one, because he just comes at, like, the very end.
Yeah, Frank is just there.
Yeah, but the narrator and the first two children, and I forget.
I think
it's
Angela.
Angela, yeah. Those two, those three are the main characters, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel so bad. So my reaction, my review of the characters is they're all terrible and annoying.
You know what's funny? I like this book and I agree.
Yeah. And I can realize that's the point. I can, like, logically, while I was reading this, I was like, oh, like, I'm not supposed to be cheering for Jonah, especially when he just, like, became president. And, like, throughout the book, I was like, I mean, from the beginning, the very first page when he starts talking, I'm like, ugh, yeah, this man is insufferable. But then everything he does after that, I'm like, oh, my goodness. Like, what are you doing? So I can, like, understand. I can understand that, like, this is one of those, like, book stories that is written where, like, you know, it's not, it's like the anti-hero. Not really an anti-hero, but, like, yeah. that concept of, like, you're not fully, like, you're not, like, just, like, cheering on the protagonist.
Yeah, it's a concept where the protagonist is not necessarily, like, the ultimate good guy that you're cheering on. The protagonist is just where the center is and who yeah. the story is following.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they happen to be a good guy in most of the stories. In this story, not so much.
Yeah. Yeah, just a really a treat, if you will, in the most sarcastic way that I can describe it. Yeah, it was really interesting. I kind of just like summarized, first of all, he's really creepy. This is Jonah. I'm talking about Jonah. He's very creepy. which
especially
I will
at the end when he goes after that. Oh my.
The 18-year-old child?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh yeah. So no, I have. Oh my goodness. The way he describes her. And
it
further
is so
on
80s.
Though, the way he describes like young women in general. Or not, okay, I hate young women. I don't know why I said that. Girls. The way he describes girls is just like, it's revolting. And then he's also just like, the general like tone of his like outlook on life is like very ableist, misogynistic, racist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like very... I guess what you're, well, kind of what I was expecting, but I'm still always taken aback when I'm like reading it and I'm like, oh,
mm-hmm.
wow. All yeah. right. This is not my normal reading material. But yeah, but further on top of that, I found that like he does and says all of these things, but with like an air of like, oh, I'm just being objective. Like I am just an observer yeah. of the human being.
And that's where the role of like the religion of Baconism, I don't know how to pronounce it.
I don't know.
I'll just call it Baconism.
Yes,
for now.
I think that's good.
And that I feel like that's where that role of Baconism comes in, because his obsession with that makes those views of the people he sees around him like objective. And mm-hmm. I think that kind of is a theme throughout the novel where people will have these beliefs and see them externally to validate these horrible beliefs that
yeah.
people will have about other people.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way that Jonah describes people around him, like discriminating against him and describing him as like beneath him almost.
Yeah.
And then backing it up with quotes of like a Baconist or
yeah.
someone of that religion shows how these people who have these beliefs of that there's other people below them or such get validated by just these random beliefs that say, yeah, you're right, just keep going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I definitely, yeah, it did play like a strong role in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's still, I don't know. I personally struggle to read. I think I find I'm much better watching narratives like this than reading them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that is. I think reading feels more intimate. Like
that's a very good
you're
point.
Really getting into that person's mind that's mm-hmm. like really messed up and you're like, I don't really want to be here.
I kind of feel that because when I'm reading, I always imagine like I can control how they're voiced and how they're moving, and
yeah.
I create that movie in my mind. And so when I take that picture of Jonah in my mind and make him do those things, it's like, wait, am I doing that? I don't
yeah.
want to do that.
Yeah, you're like, I don't want you to do this.
Yeah.
Like I'm in, yeah, because it feels like you're, yeah, kind of like looking over the character's shoulder the
mm-hmm.
whole time that you're like reading it. And I even get this like when I read romance novels, and this is like, okay. Side note to romance, but people hate the miscommunication trope in romance, which
oh
basically...
Oh my God. No, please go on. I need to hear another perspective about this.
I find them immensely entertaining.
I need to know how.
Okay, I tell you, it's like when I watch Hallmark movies. It's like...
Okay, that's a fair
like,
point.
It's like... I know exactly what's going to happen. Also, I love drama. Like, I love Vampire Diaries because it's so dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love drama. And when I want drama, I want so much of it. Like, I want it to just be, like, thrown in my face one after the other.
God, but how do you not, like, suffer when the miscommunication happens? When I'm reading like a romance novel and a miscommunication happens, I'm in those shoes. I'm like, no.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say. It's like, it is very, but I think I like that feeling. Like, I said this in the first episode of the show and my co-host looked at me like, are you okay? But I was like, I love reading devastation. Like, I love reading about characters being devastated. But here's the thing about things that aren't actually that big of a deal. like the idea that, like, you know, your boyfriend saw a picture of you hugging a man and now thinks you're cheating on him. Mm-hmm. Like, that sort of, like, it feels devastating. And when it's written really well, this is the thing. When the miscommunication trope is written very well, I find it can be, like, engaging, because to me it's very low stakes, because I know when I read 50 pages on, they're going to resolve it. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a happy ending. Mm-hmm. So it's like that kind of like formulaic drama.
I kind of don't have that closure. For some reason in my mind, I'm always like, but there could be a chance. Maybe they won't get together. Please. I need Bobby and Angela to get together.
It's, yeah. Anyways, I don't. How did we end up here?
I think to tie it back, I kind of get that feeling. I kind of get that, like, interest in devastation with this novel. Mm. Not to say I enjoy, like, reading the horrible things that happen, but I have kind of this fascination with books that are written like this, where the characters are, like, awful. The main protagonists are awful.
Yeah.
Because a lot of books they recommended that are mainstream and really popular are protagonist is a good person who does good things and you want to follow them along. And there's not really much exploration in, I guess, how humans interact. And this exploration of how, I guess, just how gross it could be is really fascinating, because no one ever really discusses it. No one really ever talks about it because we want to avoid it. But reading about it is a reminder of why we want to avoid it. You know, there's a reason we don't talk about, you know, the hate speech that is being promoted out there. And, you know, you have to realize why we don't promote that. It's because it's a terrible thing that hurts other people and it mm-hmm. hurts communities mm-hmm. and it hurts individuals and their beliefs. And we should not be endorsing it, but we also need to realize why we're not endorsing it, or else there's going to be people who say, you know, they're censoring me or whatever. I can't spew my hate speech. They're censoring me and stuff like that. But we need to reinforce, no, we don't allow hate speech specifically because it damages people, communities, and mm-hmm. their lives.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting idea and interesting perspective when applied to this book. Because, yeah, like, this book is definitely – it's not about the good guys, but we're going to take a very quick break and we'll be back in a couple minutes with some more discussion on this book.
Guayaki Yerba Mate. Yerba Mate is a naturally caffeinated drink that comes in a variety of formats, from loose leaf to cans to bottles. Yes, the yellow ones. Guayaki Mate is all organic, non-GMO, and sure to make you come to life. Guayaki is more than just a Yerba Mate brand. They're focused on personal, social, ecological, and cultural growth through their commitment to regenerative practices, which include stewarding the South Atlantic rainforest and partnering with indigenous South American communities through the production of Yerba Mate. Visit guayaki.com, GUAYAKI.com, to learn more and find this delicious drink near you. Or stop by CITR station on UBC campus for a free Yerba Mate can.
On January 17th, CITR 101.9 FM presents our annual 24 Hours of Radio Art Programming, featuring innovative approaches to music and sound. It's 24 hours of spoken word, ambient, drone, field recordings, and sound walks, collage, technical support calls, voicemail fails, sound art, and noise. Listen live on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
Love being caffeinated?
And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
You are tuned into 101.9 FM at CITR Radio. I'm Cleo Skivinsky, and I'm the Indigenous Collective Lead here at CITR. I am coming to you over the radio waves to let you know that Unseed Airwaves is back on the air and stronger than ever. We are centering Indigenous joy, brilliance, and current issues on our episode. Unseeded Airways broadcasts on Thursday evenings at 7 to 9 p.m. and replays on the following Monday at 4 p.m. to 5 p.m.
All right. Hello, hello. Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. This is Randy, and you're listening to another episode of Dog-Eared Radio Book Club, a biweekly book club coming to you through the airwaves of CITR 101.9 FM. I'm joined today by guest person, Matt.
Hello, I'm Matt.
Fantastic. And we are talking about the book Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut. Very interesting conversation so far. A little bit of a mess. I'll just reiterate that this book is also a mess, so you can't be mad at us if you're listening. So I think we left off on this kind of discussion of like the idea that like there's no really like heroes in this book, mm-hmm. or even like a villain for that matter. Like it's definitely not like a.
That's a point I wanted to bring up actually. The villain isn't. I don't think the villain. I was reading on my trip to Seattle about Kurt Vonnegut's graduation speeches and his talk about the philosophy, his philosophy and outlook of like made me realize that in this book, the antagonist is not necessarily a character. It's the concept of taking science too far.
Yeah.
That's what I feel like the antagonist is. That's what I was going to bring up. I'm just going to talk about this here. So I feel like a main point about this book is not only about talking about how kind of ridiculous interactions with humans can be, but also about the ironic absurdity that comes with pushing science too far. And that's explored with researching about the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Science is something that, you know, it feels like you should pursue it, something that feels like we need to research more of it so we can extend life and invest in healthcare and stuff like that. But this book genuinely challenges one of my beliefs by almost being anti-science, which is really strange. Kurt Vonnegut was a really big skeptic on scientists and investing in science because he always saw the scientists go to the military-industrial complex. And that's example here with the atomic bomb. And that's how it still is today.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists and engineers, you know, they're given money, they're promoted, but they're still being sent to the military-industrial complex to fund the defense. It just keeps stockpiling up on numbers.
Yeah.
And this book is really shocking to me because I grew up basically raised by scientists, mm-hmm. basically raised by people who wanted to keep pushing science. And to read a book that's like, no, we need to stop before we blow ourselves up, basically. And that's how he uses the Ice Nine, the catastrophe that, am I allowed to spoil?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. I always forget to say it because in my head I'm like, oh, well, it's implied. It's
yeah.
But yeah, spoilers.
Like, that's how Ice Nine, the main catastrophic weapon, destroys the world. It's because the military-industrial complex used scientists and science in general to just make this completely absurd weapon just for the sake of absurdity.
It's very Thanos.
Yeah. It's a whole critique about the arms race and how, like, about how the U.S. kept investing in more military just to flex and show off. But then when there's nobody around to flex to and you look at what you actually invested, you have a bunch of weapons that are going to kill millions of people. And what do you have then at that point?
Yeah, I came up with a similar point. I don't know when it like occurred to me. I think it was when he, like, in the beginning of the book, when he was talking to people about Felix, the doctor that invented the atomic bomb. And they were like, because a lot of people, like, applauded him. And then he met this one person that was like, well, was he that great? Like, you know, did he need to do that? Like, was there actually a point to that? And it brought up, and we actually talked about this with regard to AI in our first episode when we talked about Claire and the Sun. Bailey and I talked about this idea of like the idea of just inventing to invent and pushing science just to push it. Like, what is the point of what you're doing and who are you doing it for?
Yeah.
If to not just like do it. And I think this is to me like the point that I got from it is like, yeah, like, you know, this Felix was applauded as being so smart and he's so brilliant. But yet, like, I remember there's one part where, I don't know, one of the kids says, well, he never read. And I made a note, well, how do you know anything about the world and humanity if you don't read? Like, I learn everything I know about humans, well, from interacting with them, but also reading. Like, I think reading is how you learn a lot about the human condition and people, you know, and especially in other parts of the world, right? And so I think that just, I get, like, I really agree with what you're saying, that, like, that is one of the major points I drew from this book of, like, the idea of just doing it to do it because I'm smart and I'm better and I'm just going to keep pushing, you know, science and I'm not going to recognize the harm. And then also, obviously, the military's role in that.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to suggest this book as a part of sci-fi, because it follows that sci-fi trope of, you know, being a skeptic of technology and stuff like that. But it also really pushes the idea that, like, okay, we need to actually stop. Because consider, like, when the time it was made, you know, people were pushing for more weapons, more guns to show off against the big bad USSR that we've got bombs. But then you just have a bunch of bombs. Like, when you look at that, it's like, okay, you have a bunch of bombs that will kill millions of people. I'm terrified. Terrified of that concept that we're sitting on. You know, a story about how they were transporting, like, nuclear bombs across the east coast of the U.S. and they accidentally dropped one and then it went missing. It didn't detonate.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's somewhere in the U.S. and nobody's ever found it. It's terrifying. And it's because of that mass investment in the military-industrial complex. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah, it's definitely even, like, I don't know. I always, like, whenever I get on this show and we're talking about these larger concepts, I always pull from, like, the latest media that I've read or watched. So I'm watching Murdoch Mysteries right now. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I do not know what that
is. It's a very famous Canadian TV show. And it's about this detective, Murdoch, who is a detective in Toronto during, like, the late 1890s to, like, early 1900s. Anyways, and they brought in, like, in a few episodes, there's this, like, military guy that, like, comes in. So in one of these episodes, this guy is murdered and he's found, like, in a tree. And so they believe that he committed or he unalived himself. And so, but they investigate it further. Anyways, and they find out that he was basically pushed out of this, like, military aircraft. This is, like, the early 1900s, so it's like this weird, I don't even know how to describe it, but it's like well, it's kind of, oh, what do you call those things that the Hindenburg that blew up?
Blimps?
Yeah, it's like a blimp, I guess, kind of. Okay. Same thing, like a hot air balloon. I don't know. Anyways, but it, like, in the episode, this military guy, I can't remember his name, was kind of just, like, defending it. It was like, well, it was one person that died, you know, like, we're doing this to protect their country. We're doing this for the greater good. And I always think of that, and obviously this is just, like, a, you know, old cop show entertainment. But I think those notions are so, I don't know. I think that notion is so ingrained in all of us of, like, to me, it's absurd that you would try to defend, you know, this idea of, like, oh, we're sacrificing these people, you know, for science or for the greater good. And, like, the idea that, like, I don't know, creating more bombs and weapons. Like, where has that gotten us?
Yeah, and I think that's only gotten worse, honestly, as the population has grown, just because the number keeps getting bigger, and we can't comprehend that number. So that mindset is reinforced, where it's like, we can't comprehend how many human lives this is. Just any number is a worthy sacrifice in the name of progression or whatever. And yeah, just that's gotten more reinforced over time, especially, honestly, with the digital age, making faces almost invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels like the more you interact online, it feels like you're not even interacting with people anymore. You're just interacting with bots. You're just interacting with numbers. And then you start to get into that mindset that this whole book is making fun of, is being absurd about, this idea that we can just sacrifice whatever in the name of science, in the name of progression. But but what progression?
Yeah.
I've realized this is a completely off-topic point, but my New Year's theme is about how I want to focus on being resilient, but also understanding why I'm being resilient. I want to develop habits, but I also want to understand why I'm developing the habits in the first place. And that relates with this as well. It's important to make progress in the world. Without progress, we're just going to be like a stick in the mud. We're not going to get anywhere. But this book talks about, it critiques, is that, okay, you can make progress, but if you don't actually know what the progress is, if you just say progress is making a bunch of bombs, where does that get anywhere?
Mm-hmm.
You need to understand where the progress goes. We need to make progress to help people, to make people feel safer in their homes, to make people feel safer in their bodies. That's why we're pushing, that's why progress nowadays means inclusivity, equality, because progress is meant to help people.
Mm-hmm.
Progress is not meant to hurt others. Progress is meant to push forward rather than just restrain everyone back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where I'm going with this. I'm just rambling.
I get like that too. I'm like, oh yeah,
that's
have my point.
Like.
And yeah, it's like you're there and your point's there. But I think I understand where you're coming from. I think there's, and this is the disconnect whenever I talk to like, quote unquote, like more conservative right wing people,
mm-hmm.
is just this idea that like they want progress, but they don't actually want it to happen.
Yeah.
And it's this idea, and like, which is to me, I feel like I've said the word absurd like 10 times already, but it's absurd to me because the entire idea of conservativeness is conserving. You're conserving the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
So, how would you think by conserving the status quo, you would create any change and or progress?
Mm-hmm.
Which, yeah, I think it's really interesting that, and I think this book does more so, it definitely does touch on politics, obviously, like they mentioned, like being the, what's his name? Well, both the private business guy that ends up on the island. I can't remember any, like, I literally just finished it today. Like, what am I?
Something strange about this book is that you don't know any of the characters' names, but you know all the concepts and plots that happen. Which I have not had a book do that for me as much as this book. Like, whenever I finish a book, I always remember the characters. I know Ford Prefect from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I know this guy from that book.
Mm-hmm.
But with this, I barely even remembered the main character's name. I knew Newt just because that was one weird name. But
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah. But like, because on the plane when he's flying to San Lorenzo, I think it's
San Lorenzo.
Yeah. The island, then he encounters the ambassador couple and then also like the private business guy that's going to go there and start a factory. I don't know.
Was that the Indianapolis couple?
Maybe.
I don't, that whole
section. Well, they were from the
so
Midwest because they were like, we're Hoosiers or
that's
Hoosers
what it was.
Or whatever.
That whole part was one of the most confusing parts of the whole book.
Yeah. But like that, when you got to that section, I was like, this is very American. Because they like started talking about like being anti-communist and they're like, oh, like communists must die and like America first. So yeah, it's very interesting that they like did that to bring that in. Because yeah, I think this book definitely has a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
What did I want? There was something that I think you touched upon that I wanted to talk more about. Oh, I think this kind of relates to the idea of, like, scientists and, like, science, like, just pushing and pushing for, like, whatever reason. There's this quote. I'm going to read it. It's on page 68. But basically, I don't know who's talking to him, but he's talking to someone about, oh, it was the Dr. Breed.
For some reason, that's not clicking. And I don't
that's okay. Remember. He was, like, one of the first doctor, like, the first people after... like after he wrote the letter to you. I don't even know how he ended up there, but somehow he ended up interviewing with this guy. And I think this Dr. Breed worked with Felix, the doctor. That
I think
created.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. And he's very insignificant again in the entire span of the novel, mm-hmm. but he says this one thing where he basically just talks about how like, he didn't really know how human this Felix was. And so he says, this is a quote from the book. He shuddered, quote, "Sometimes I wonder if he wasn't born dead. I never met a man who was less interested in the living. Sometimes I think that's the trouble with the world. Too many people in high places who are stone cold dead," end quote.
I remember highlighting that quote.
Yeah. Well. And I did think that was an interesting, I even wrote good quote. because I think that's like, sometimes we look at science as being so impersonal and objective.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting to me. So I started out in engineering and I transferred to a gender studies degree after. And I definitely went into it being like science, math, this is all objective. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we just have facts. They just happen. This is the way the world works. And then I went into gender studies and I was like, wow, all of this is just subjective. Everything is subjective. Nothing is objective. There's way too many forces within our world that we've both created, but also natural things that make it so this isn't objective. Mm-hmm. So I think that to me is another thing I draw on from this book of like, you can tell that this Felix, based on what people have talked about him, he had this idea that science is objective and he's doing things and he's pushing because he's smart and he can do it. So why not do it?
Mm-hmm.
And there doesn't seem to be a thought process given to be like, well, if I do create this, how would that impact, you know, other people mm-hmm. or other people? And I say that like with the caveat of like based on what other people are telling us, because we don't actually get to talk to him. So we have no idea how he felt about the things he did, which I think is also very interesting.
That's a really good point that you brought up about the other perspective saying, okay, but that saying that it's we need to stop being objective and that there's actually a subjectivity to it. Because one of the most important parts, and my favorite part about the whole book, is the symbolism of the cat's cradle. There's a quote later on, I forget the exact quote, but it's when Jonah is talking to Newt the painter, and Newt is showing Jonah the cat's cradle game, and they do it with their hands. And he's showing, it's supposed to be a metaphor, a display of how, like, he says, oh, this is supposed to look like a cat's cradle. But the actual, when you look at it, it's just a bunch of strings.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at it, it's just a bunch of random lines together. And he says, I remember this. I have this ingrained in my mind. He says, see the cat? See the cradle? And he's questioning it, like mocking it.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't actually look like a cat's cradle. It's just a bunch of strings.
Mm-hmm.
We don't actually... Nothing in the world is necessarily objective. We've just attached a bunch of meanings to it and a bunch of our own ideas to it, and people follow that as objective.
Mm-hmm.
The rules and policies and beliefs that we've set up are all subjective. As you've been saying, like when you switched to gender studies, you saw that it's all subjective. The
mm-hmm.
ideas placed by humankind, nothing is concrete, but the way it's been raised and
mm-hmm.
reinforced by officials, again, that quote, by the people in high places, it's led to be objective. And that's what Felix has fallen into. That's what he's
mm-hmm.
fallen victim into, leading that it is objective. And when someone comes in and says, hey, what if it's actually not? Then it
mm-hmm.
actually disrupts the whole process. It disrupts the setup by those cold people in power.
Yeah, well, and I just, like, you know, looking at this book, like, the way, I'm going to talk about this more, because we have to talk about misogyny and sexism in this book, but whenever they talk about Angela, who's the daughter, and also the oldest sibling of Felix, they basically, so when their mother died, he pulled her out of school to basically was like, okay, you have to raise these, like, your siblings now. Mm-hmm. But it's really interesting because they're very dismissive of her, but she is definitely the most, like, protective of her father's identity as being a hero. Mm-hmm. Which there's so many layers of all, like, that girl needs therapy. Like, the amount of trauma that these kids had, we can't even touch upon that. But I just think that aspect of that relationship is very interesting. Like, that deludedness? I don't know if that's a word.
We'll make it one.
Yeah. It makes sense in the context. kind of like, you know, convincing yourself that, like, oh, no, that it makes sense. I think this book in general, and this is, you know, coming to read this book after, you know, basically having completed my degree, the reason why I say, like, oh, I don't really like it and it doesn't add anything is because I know all of these things. Mm-hmm. Like, I've learned all of these things from the many works that I've read by women, and specifically women of color, throughout mm-hmm. my degree. But I do think this, like, because to me, this is the very, like, white male and also, like, a certain, like, class element or, like, privilege element, right? Because, like, we were talking about this before the show started, like, it's not that these ideas are new, it's just that he had the privilege and the power to say them out loud.
Exactly.
Whereas a lot of people thought these same things and were saying these same things, it's just they didn't get to write them down and publish them in a book. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that, like, retracts from it, but whenever I read books like this, I always think about, well, like, because, like, they very, like, quickly mention the actual bomb being dropped, mm-hmm. which, like, I didn't even know happened until I went to university. I never learned about that in my unit on World War II in high school. Mm-hmm. No one told me that. So I think, I don't even know where I'm going with this. But
it's just like the book.
Yeah, I think just, like, my general point is, like, coming at these topics from different perspectives and different understandings is important. Mm-hmm. So I think what I will say, if you are going to read this book, understand this is, like, a very, very tiny piece of the puzzle of understanding these ideas.
Oh, yeah.
And I encourage you to, like, go beyond this book. Mm-hmm. Anyways.
This book is really, it's not the ultimate pinnacle, greatest critique of American society.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, it's a really good starting point and really good generalization of mm-hmm. what it is, because it encapsulates so many different ideas. And the perspective that you bring to this book will really develop both how you perceive the topics brought in and also how you perceive the world.
Yeah.
This book has really helped me, like, understand, you know, the base ideas of human conflict and stuff like that. And now that I'm learning through university interacting, I'm seeing the layers of misogyny that were, like, hidden, that were abruptly there.
Yeah.
But the concepts blindsided me to it. And now I'm actually being shown work that was written before this that touches on the same topics, mainly written by women, people of color, that were not promoted as much. And it's layers of learning throughout this book, layers mm-hmm. of perceiving and different perspectives. Because that's all life is. Mm-hmm. It's how you perceive the works that are presented to you. It's how you present, how you perceive the concepts presented to you. And understanding both the main concepts presented in the book and also the underlying misogyny and racism that lies beneath it all, that is really important to understand how those concepts and ideas are brought up in the first place and how he even got the privilege to be able to write this down and publish it, when everyone in the past who tried their best, who followed the idea that if you just work hard and do it, you'll get there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is it's very true. And I think what's also interesting, kind of, I think building on what you said and also, like, going back to, I think, the point I was trying to make, I think to me that's, like, it's interesting because this is, like, the first critique of these things that I've read by someone who is basically part of it.
Yeah.
Like, not, like, part of it in, like, the way that, like, oh, like, Kurt Vonnegut was a scientist for the military, but, like, you know, like, from someone who had, like, as far as, like, the privileges go, to, like, understand almost this, like, upper echelon world, to mm-hmm. that to a lot of people who have talked about these problems, it's a different positionality, right? Because we all, like, our positions of, like, our position and approximation to power affect our view on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is one thing. One interesting thing I can say about this book is this is, like, the author is a different position to power. So yeah. Therefore, his views and the way he writes about it is going to be different than other people.
Instead of, like, for instance, an author looking from the outside, looking into a power structure, it's someone within that power structure putting his hands down and looking around the table to see what's around him. Mm-hmm. And that's really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. We're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, we'll get into some more. Maybe we'll talk about this misogyny that we've been hinting at. I think I have a few quotes that we can dive into.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Do you want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing health care, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder, because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
Are you interested in conversations about intersectionality? Listen to Intersections, presented by CITR 101.9 FM's Intersectionality Collective, a show where we tackle a range of topics that impact gender, race, sexuality, and social justice, like anti-fat bias, understanding microaggressions, and racism in the food industry. Tune into Intersections bi-weekly on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM. Each episode will feature either a panel discussion from the members of the Intersectionality Collective or an expert on that week's topic. So tune in and also check out our episode archive on citr.ca/intersections.
All right, and we're back from that very, very quick ad break. So I'm Randy, and you're currently listening to Dog-Eared Radio Book Club, a bi-weekly book club coming to you through the airs, oh my gosh, through the airwaves of CITR 101.9 FM. I'm joined today by co-host Matt.
Hello, I'm Matt.
Awesome. And we're talking about the book Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut. And we have talked about a lot of things, but we decided during the break that we're going to talk about misogyny. So if I could lay out kind of what I noticed in this book, right off the bat, I made the very astute observation that I wasn't going to like this guy because of a lot of his views on women. But I think as far as to summarize my thinking, I think I want to read a couple quotes that just kind of stuck with me. And I was like, why is this written like this? I don't think they really need a content warning. They're just uncomfortable, if I describe. So there's this part where he's talking, he's describing when he's led into this building, he's describing these two people showing their badges to get into the building, and this is how it's described. Quote. Miss Pefko showed the guard on the left the pink confidential badge on the tip of her left breast. Dr. Breed showed the guard on our right the black top secret badge on his soft lapel. End quote. So I just when I was I read this and then I read it again and then I read it out loud to my dad and I was like, what? Why would you describe it like that? And I was even now I'm trying to be what would that look like? What is, yeah. It's just, I know it's like a really small thing, and I'm sure there's people, if like anyone's listening, you're like, why are you reacting like that? I think it's just because like, it's just annoying. To me, that's like an Definitely. Annoying thing. I'm like, why did, it makes no sense.
It's certain vocab terms, like, why do you say the breast? Like, this is kind of.
But also, like, nothing is on the tip. Like, where is the tip of her breast that she would put the badge? Like, do you understand, like, where that is, like, physically? Because, yeah. like, I've never seen someone with a badge on the tip of their, yeah, anyways. So that was just more of an absurd one where I was like, this just seems, you know, unnecessary. Mm-hmm. But then we get into the real fun stuff when our nice little Jonah starts to talk about Mona.
God.
So Mona is the adopted daughter of yes. the president of San Lorenzo.
Yes.
Okay. And it's also to my understanding that she is indigenous to the island as well?
I think so, yes.
Yes. So this is just disturbing. So I'm just going to read some of the ways that he describes her. Also, she's 18. Yeah. And this, I don't know how old Joan is. He's got to be like 50, 60.
I think he's around like 40s, something 40. Like that.
Either way.
Which it doesn't make it any better.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
He is a grown man with two ex-wives. thank God he doesn't have any kids. Okay. So he's looking at a magazine, and on the cover of the magazine is a picture of Mona. Okay, so this is on page 80, quote, "I was in no hurry to read the contents. The girl on the cover was enough for me, more than enough, since I had fallen in love with her on sight. She was very young and very grave, too, and luminously compassionate and wise. She was as brown as chocolate. Her hair was like golden flax. Her name was Mona Amons Monzano, the cover said. She was adopted daughter of the dictator of the island." Okay, I'm going to end quote there. But yeah, so I flagged this as being not great from the beginning. And I think I flagged it more so like the colonial perspective of like the infantilization and like very gross attraction to like a kind of like an indigenous person, mm-hmm. if I were to like phrase it in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find out, sorry, do you want to add anything before I go on?
Well, I think that this recommending these types of books makes this so difficult.
Yeah.
Because you see it immediately and then the thing, why would you recommend this? And it's like, wait. Okay. This is awful. This is a sign of the times, and this is a sign of Veronica. Just, it's really disgusting writing, and Jonah is a disgusting character. And it's a sign of, like, how, I guess, the human, I don't know how to articulate it, but going back to that idea about how the beliefs reinforce these disgusting ideals, like how Bokanism reinforces that misogyny, the colonization has reinforced the idea that, like, oh, you're superior to someone else. These beliefs and the way that the world has functioned to create hierarchies has made people believe these awful things. And I don't know what the right term is, but I guess be infatuated with this idea of conquering or the idea of showing that you are more powerful than somebody else just because an institution has told you that you should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think if I were to, like, kind of add to what you're saying, like, as far as, like, recommending these books, I'm very open that I just don't like books like this.
Yeah.
It's kind of like an ongoing, I don't want to say, I hate labeling everything as a debate, but a discussion of, like, do we need books that, you know, have this type of writing and behavior, mm-hmm. but it's supposed to be like a critique of it. It's not like a support.
That's what I've thought about that for a while now.
And that's like that's an ongoing thing. I don't really have, I think for the most part, in a lot of cases, I'm okay with it. I think it's just from my experience, it never, like, works. Like, you know, people say that Fight Club and The Wolf of Wall Street were supposed to be satire. Okay, I don't know a single straight white finance bro that knows that they're satire. They just think that they're their heroes.
Yeah.
So I'm like, is it really working?
That's why it makes it insufferable to talk about those movies on an analytical level.
Yeah.
So, like,
because they're just like, yeah, what? I was going to say something, but I can't because it's on radio. But anyways, I think we all know what I was – okay. but, yeah, so I think this book kind of, like, falls into that. So I think, like, I have a much easier time if I were to, like, recommend this to, like, you know, my cousin or, like, you know, someone that I was, like, close with in my program or had these views to begin with, I would be like, oh, this might be interesting. Like, you might think, you know, it's something. Like, you might – what we were talking about, like, your experience in combination with reading it, you'll get something out of it. Like, even for me, as much as I came in here, I was like, I did not like this book. I hated it. It doesn't mean I didn't get anything out of it because I got this conversation. I think, like, would I pick this book up on my own to read it? 1,000% not. Absolutely. I didn't even know where to find it. I had to ask the person at the bookstore, like, 3 times because I was like, I don't go in the classics area. I own one copy of Pride and Prejudice.
I still haven't read that book.
It's
that's controversial. I've heard multiple people be like, how could you not read Pride and Prejudice?
Because she spends like 10 pages describing one thing. Yeah, anyways, it's a good book to fall asleep to. I'm very harsh on it. Anyways, but I think, like, you know, as but I just really think, like, I don't know, to me, but the reason I love to point out this stuff and be very, like, you know, like, intense about it almost is because I don't want people to be able to just, like, applaud it. Which, like, when I was talking to a lot of guys that I work with, they would just be like, oh, yeah, Kurt Vonnegut. Like, he's, yeah, like, I love Slaughterhouse-Five. I love this book. And I'd be like, okay, well, since you called your girlfriend the B word this morning, I'm going to assume that you probably didn't notice all of these things.
Yeah, that's the important thing about discussing this book is to realize you really need to take one step forward more than just looking at what, like, the words themselves.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of these dude bros will see Vonnegut's like, man, he's this really righteous guy, and the way that Jonah is infatuated with this girl in a really weird way, man, I should do that. No, you don't.
Yeah.
It's not that you want to do it. Think one step further. And it's back to our conversation about how your perspective changes the way you interpret these things and how the book and the concepts it presents is all about challenging your perspectives and making you think one layer deeper.
Yeah. Well, and also, like, you know, what I've always encountered like this is people that'll be like, yeah, but it's not real. Okay, you don't think it's real that there's like older men that are obsessed with young girl? Like, that is 100%. We know that that happens. Yeah. We know that, like, I literally could list 10 people I knew in high school who were dating men in their 20s when they were 16 or 17. Okay, so we don't need to have a conversation whether that's real or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's real, and it has real life consequences. So I think that's, to me, like, and this was just, it was so, like, grossly laid out.
Yeah.
Of, like, how, like, you know, intense this idea and, like, his, like, and you can tell, like, Jonah did not view Mona as human.
Yeah.
And that's, like, made very evident when they actually, like, are together in the end.
Mm-hmm.
He basically admits to essaying her.
Yeah.
And, like, so I think, to me, like, that's the – I really wonder if, like, there's anyone out there that, like, thinks Jonah is a good person. Do you think there is?
God, I hope not.
I hope so, too.
I don't know, because, like, it's supposed to – it depends if it's the type of person who's thinks that the protagonist is always supposed to be, like, the ideal person.
Mm-hmm.
I see discourse about this on Twitter. I don't know why I'm on Twitter, but I see discourse about it, like, oh, why is the protagonist, like, a mean person? It's like, God, I hope I don't interact with a person like Jonah. Like,
yeah.
Ever.
Yeah. Well, I have several times, but which makes the book that much more eerie because it's like, wow, these people actually exist. But anyways, that's just, I think for me, the misogyny and the sexism and those elements were kind of the first thing I noticed. And personally, and I think this is why I tend to stay away from books like this, is it draws me out of it. It takes me straight out of whatever I'm supposed to be reading.
I can definitely see that.
Because I'm just like, this feels very unnecessary. Which is probably why I don't read the classics.
Yeah.
I read my classics.
That's a fair point about different perspectives. I feel like I kind of went into this with somewhat of a privilege. Like, I'm a white guy who can just read this as a white guy. I don't have that perspective of someone who is not white or male walking into this and seeing those details and being uncomfortable with them. It's the struggle with controversial things like this, because they're all written by white men. It's trying to realize the perspectives of other people out there who are not white men and understand the layers that come with discussing these controversial topics is really tricky. And I feel like it's really important to note that, depending on your experiences, who you are, and how you perceive the world.
Yeah, it's a very, I almost said it's a mixed bag. That is not what I meant, though. I don't know why that term pops in my head, but I'm not going to say that. But I do think this draws into what you also mentioned you want to chat about during the break, which is the cynicism in this novel, which I definitely have my thoughts about. But I'm curious if you want to kick off that conversation.
The way I want to kick off is that I was reading this collection of Kurt's graduation speeches, there was an introduction in the beginning that was describing Kurt Vonnegut as a writer, which states that he's a writer that gives the readers sugar pills that are coated in cyanide. And I think that's a really good way of presenting it. He presents it's kind of backwards cynicism almost, because I have a lot of thoughts about cynicism and the philosophy of cynicism in general, but the way that Vonnegut presents cynicism in his works and his speeches in general is that if you look on the surface layer, a lot of stuff is really depressing. The events that happen in this book are disgusting, awful, and just absurd. I know we keep saying absurd, but the underlying meaning that he tries to provide, not just in this book, but in his philosophy in general, is that there is something important about humans that we should be proud of, proud about our expression, proud about our ability to connect with one another, our ability for creativity and connection with people who are not like us, that don't have the same experiences as us, and regardless of what we look like, how we act like, we still have the opportunity to connect with one another. It presents cynicism, but reverts it back to optimism to remind us why it's pretty sick to be human.
That's a more optimistic take than I had. But I appreciate the amount of research you also did into like Kurt Vonnegut himself. I definitely intended to do that, but unfortunately I do have a final tomorrow, so it didn't take precedent.
Fair. The thing about cynicism is that I hate the idea that delving into cynicism kind of provides something in the world. Because if you're just talking about how the world sucks over and over again, it's like, what do you even gain from that? It kind of goes back to my point about the military-industrial complex. You create these weapons over and over just to show how smart, how cool you are. You say the world sucks just to show how smart you are. But then you just think the world sucks and you're alone. And everyone knows you as the guy that hates everything.
And, okay, so this was my perspective on it, too. I felt like, you know, the idea, okay, I'm going to try to succinctly say this. The idea that Jonah, a white dude, is telling me the world sucks makes me want to punch him in the face. Because it's like, yeah, dude, I know. And it sucks more in 2022 than it did in 1980, whatever, this book. Is it even based in the 80s? I feel like it's not.
I don't even remember.
Doesn't even matter. They don't even tell you. They're like, it's after the Second World War. That's the only context we have. And they have airplanes.
I guess so.
I don't know.
That's how they got to San Lorenzo.
But it's like an airplane with a bar. Anyways, it doesn't matter. maybe it's a boat.
No, it was definitely a plane.
I think it was a plane, yeah. Okay, anyways, doesn't matter. back to my point. like, that just, it irks me. There's something about it. And I think, to me, it leads back to, like, I think the right term is, like, climate nihilism. Is that the right word?
I think so.
Where it's just like, oh, all hope is lost. We can't do anything, you know. Like, we're just, like, I can't even think of, like, an analogy now. But exactly, like, this entire just perspective that's just completely, like, nihilistic and, like, end of the world, like, doomsday perspective. Mm-hmm. Because to me, it's like, there are people out there that have hope. Like, and I think, to me, hope is a lot of what humanity is based on. Like, yeah. What are humans without hope?
Yeah, I think that's why Jonah is inherently a flawed character. Because he delves into that cynicism, but doesn't go anywhere with it.
Yeah.
He's just the guy who says, we're all gonna die or whatever, and then at the end of the novel, everyone's frozen and dead, and he's just by himself.
Yeah.
That's where he ends up when he just delves into cynicism and whines about it and judges everyone. His beliefs about people being beneath him are reinforced, and now he's by himself with nothing to love for, nothing to live for at this point, because he's just in a frozen wasteland.
Yeah.
Because he spent the whole novel just whining. Honestly.
Wow. That's a very good summarization of the book and also of his character, because I think – and that was for me, like – and I think now, like, you know, I always find, like, when I read these books, I always come away with one emotion. And it really takes me sitting down and talking about it with someone to, like, work through that, which is why I started this show, because I read so many books and I hate not being able to talk about them.
Yeah.
It drives me up the wall because I'm like, I have so many thoughts and I also want to hear other people's thoughts. And that was something I didn't really get about it. Like, because I think I was so focused on Jonah as a character that I was like, oh, this book is just, it's cynicism. That's what it is. But now that you're, like, explaining it, I can see how it's kind of a warning against it. It's a warning against, you shouldn't just get lost in this. Like, that's not what humanity is. And so I think, yeah, I mean, I definitely agree and, like, partake in that more, that, like, you know, I don't want to get lost in that. Yeah. I don't want to, kind of, like, go deeper into that feeling, because I don't think it's productive. I don't think it leads, it definitely doesn't lead to progress.
I think that kind of happened, it's shown throughout the novel. Like, I think Newt is the only one who doesn't really almost die from cynicism, because when he's interviewed and he's just kind of painting, like, he's living his life. He shows these ideas to Jonah, and he understands that the ideas around us, that these institutions, are all subjective. But just because they're subjective, it doesn't mean we have to unalive ourselves just because things are subjective. And, you know, you reinforce the ideas that everything sucks and we should just sit around in a hole and not have any hope. Having that hope is what brings us our humanity. And the people in the book who don't realize that, the people in the book who don't learn to have hope, the people in the book like Felix who don't realize the subjective and emotional part that comes with science and just look at life as objective, life as objectively cynical, life as a game of numbers, those are the people who are doomed to suffer, because they're not actually looking at life for what it is. They see life as just black and white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also think that goes into, like, the way this book talks about religion and brings in religion. I don't think it's, like, a critique that all religion is bad.
Yeah.
I think it's that practicing a religion in a certain way is bad, and it's harmful to humanity. Because as you were saying, like, you know, he basically uses it to reinforce every bad, you know, like, when he dismisses every single person that lives in the village on San Lorenzo as just like, oh, they don't care about it. Like, literally, when they were talking about, like, oh, well, you can just be president, they don't care. Like, they don't care about anything. Yeah. Like, I know they do. You know they do. Everyone reading this book knows they do. But this idea that just these people just completely dismiss them. But it's reinforced by this idea of whatever this one guy, I don't even know.
Baconism.
Baconon.
That's actually kind of goes with what Kurt Vonnegut was talking about in his speeches. He wasn't an atheist, but he didn't believe in God either. He wasn't the type of person to be like a strict religion hater. He just hated it when religion was used to reinforce these ideas of hierarchies and racism and misogyny. And I see that reflected in the book with the main character. It's all that is reinforced in bad practice.
Yeah, for sure. And also very confusingly.
Yeah.
I don't know how many times I skipped when he ever quoted like the Baconism.
Yeah.
Because I was just like, I don't even know what you're, like, you're literally saying nonsense. And I know that's the point, but like, I can't just read nonsense. It hurts my brain. But yeah, I think, is there anything else you want to touch upon with the book before we?
I think I got my main ideas across. I guess my defense for almost liking this book is that, yes, the things that happen in this book are terrible. They're awful. But the bad things that happen in this book are the example of people who don't understand that there's emotional layers to life and that have their bad ideas and habits reinforced by these institutions and beliefs, and that they choose to indulge on these ideas of hierarchies. It's an example both of how humanity can be beautiful in the sense that we can connect with other people, that humans are kind of stupid, but also that's kind of just what humans are. But also, if you don't take the time to learn about life, learn about who other people are, if you don't take that time to connect with other people and just you stay inside in your own head and don't indulge in what life can potentially fully be, you're going to suffer from that. And you're going to end up frozen in a frozen wasteland covered by ice 9 by yourself talking to Baconon for some reason at the end of the novel.
Yeah, he just shows up there.
What was that?
Yeah. God. Yeah. I think I'm trying to think of how I want to summarize my thoughts on this book.
The way I describe it is that it's forcing people who say life sucks, it's forcing them to say, okay, but then what?
Yeah.
You can't just stop at life sucks.
Yeah.
Life sucks, but then what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. I think I don't know if I really want to, like, recommend this book. Like, I wouldn't be like, oh, go out and buy this book. But that's just my own view. But I will say, if you are going to read it, don't just read this book. Yeah. Like, please read another book.
Yes.
Like, about these topics. Like, you know, I don't even have recommendations right off the top of my head. But, like, there are so many people writing books who are not dudes in the 80s,
yes,
about humanity, that I think, you know, you can read this book and then go read other books. Like, go read another, you know, perspective on these topics. You know, go read a book from the perspective of someone who was a victim of war, or you know, or someone who was on the other end of all of these, you know, having, I don't know. I would love to read Angela's book, I think.
Yeah. And I think that connects with the theme of the book as a whole, because if you just get stuck in this one book, then what even are you doing? Like, are you even fully exploring life? Read this book, but also look at what other people have experienced.
Yeah.
Embrace in human connection.
Yeah. And also critique it. Like, I think to me, like, and this is why, like, when I agreed to read this book, I was like, yes, but we will be critiquing, which we obviously did. I think that was evident. But like when in my next episode, when Fabio was like, oh, I want to read Ender's Game, I just looked at them and I was like, okay. And they're like, no, but I want to like critique it. And I was like, oh yeah, no, I'm good with that. And so I think that to me is always like,
you don't have to be like the most critical person, because I think university teaches, and I say this as someone who's in their fifth year, so I feel like I have the ability to say this, it teaches you sometimes to be too critical. Mm-hmm. Like, you're so overly critical that when you read or watch anything, you're just looking
for things to critique. That's what I did in high school. I just when they say annotate this, I'd be like, your argument sucks because of this.
Yeah, and so you really like, and that's kind of like the balance that we all have to strike, right? Like, you can read this book and, I mean, if you're anything like me, you are going to spend a lot of time critiquing it, and mm-hmm. you're going to be frustrated. But hopefully you can still, like, balance that with, like, you know, getting something out of it and understanding something for it. And if you are a finance bro, a dude bro, don't read this book. Please don't read this book.
Please don't read
this
book.
You don't need to. You're not going to get anything out of it. And you're just going to come up to me and be like, well, I love Kurt Vonnegut. He's my hero. And be like, well, that's the reason that anyways. Yeah. All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of this episode.
I think so.
The end of our discussion on Cat's Cradle. Oh, I never even asked this question. Did you used to play Cat's Cradle when you were a kid?
I had no idea what Cat's Cradle was until I read this book. I literally have no idea what it even looks like. I've never seen it in real life. I don't even know what it is.
I wonder if this is like a age gap thing.
Maybe.
Because I did. We played it all the time in elementary school. I remember my dad made me my string. Because you need like a really long string. Mm-hmm. Really long. But yeah, we weren't very good at it. We'd get like five moves in and then we'd be like, well, we don't know what to do. So mm-hmm. we just start over and then, yeah. Anyways. Interesting.
I'll try and learn.
Yeah. One day. I mean, just look up a video about it.
Yeah.
It's definitely. Yeah. But I'm even like when I was like reading this book, I was trying to think of like, well, where did I hear about Cat's Cradle? Like, who taught me this? And it kind of just seems to be one of those things where you just like learn it on the playground or you learn it somewhere in your childhood and you don't like, you can't track it down. Which could be a nice little symbol
for something. I'm trying to think of one as well.
It's been way too long since I've taken an English class. I don't remember. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for bringing me on. I really appreciate taking the time to read the book, even if you hated it. I really appreciate it.
I will say, I don't think I hate it as much as Ender's Game.
Oh, God.
There's something about this book. Protagonist is supposed to be 6 years old, and I'm just like,
I've never read that book, but I've heard many, many, many things about it.
Many, many things? Well, many definitely things. Tune in to our next episode. I think it's on January 17th. Nice. That seems like a good right date. So people listening, you have a long time to read the book, almost an entire month. So no excuses. Definitely, you can get a used copy. Please do. Please try to get a used copy. Apparently, the author is not... doesn't have the best views on queer people.
So
you can try to get a used copy or get it out of the library, but it's a very popular book in the library. Anyways, I'm rambling now, so I'm going to bring it to a close. But thanks again, Matt, for being on the show. I really appreciate it. I think this was a really good conversation.
I think it was too.
Yeah. I hope listeners enjoyed it, even if you didn't read the book. I'm very curious if you didn't read the book and you listened to this
I have no idea what Bacchanan is or any of this.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. That was in our last episode. That was also the perspective. we were like, wow, if people are listening to this and you haven't read the book, it's a trip. It's a journey.
I imagine it would still be fun to just listen to this, though.
Oh, it is, yeah. I think we still make good points. I find like when you're dealing with this much content, like an entire novel over this long of a period of time, it tends to be like there's 10 minutes of really good conversation and there's 5 minutes of shenanigans where you're just like your brain is just trying to process everything that was said because you're doing it in real time. There's no editing happening here. Mm-hmm. You're just saying things and it's being broadcasted to... well, anywhere, because you can listen online.
Yeah.
So, anyways, this episode will be uploaded probably tomorrow. But yeah, I hope everybody has all the students. I hope they have a good break. Other people, whatever you do in December, I hope you enjoy it. And I hope everybody survives the snow in Vancouver.
Me too. I praise you. Shout out to my friend Hannah, who got their flight canceled today and has to sleep in the airport with my other two friends who got them there, and we're stuck in a SkyTrain. Hope you guys are doing well.
Oh, yeah, I hope so too. I hope you can survive off airport food. All right, until next time, have a great day.
Hello, radio world. This is Hazy. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Broadcasting Vancouver's haziest since 1950.
Shot.